Today on Maine Calling, the story of rope. If you sail boats, ride horses, work on construction sites, or climb rocks, you need rope. And those are just a few examples. Turns out humans have been depending on rope for millennia. In fact, recent discoveries of very, very old rope have altered anthropologists' conception of Neanderthal man. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Maine author Tim Queeney reveals this fascinating fact and many others in his new book, Rope: How a Bundle of Twisted Fibers Became the Backbone of Civilization. Today on Maine Calling, Queeney tells us what he discovered about rope's role in everything from the building of the pyramids to global trade to communication. And he explores how rope may shape our world in the future. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Maybe it's hanging on a hook in the garage or shoved into a box in the basement. Most of us have some rope somewhere. It is one of those things we take for granted. But a new book by a Maine author elevates rope and argues that it is one of mankind's most important inventions. The book is titled Rope: How a Bundle of Twisted Fibers Became the Backbone of Civilization. The author, Tim Queeney, joins us today. He is the former editor of Ocean Navigator, a lifelong sailor, and someone who has tied many knots. Tim, welcome to Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks. Great to be here.
Yeah, and I understand yesterday was your pub date. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, that was a great day.
Okay, so it's in bookstores today. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you use rope in an everyday manner? Have you thought about the rope that you hold in your hands? Share your thoughts via email, a short email, please, talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Well, Tim, as a sailor, of course, your experience with ropes is sheets and lines and knots. How did your interest in rope develop into a passion, or reading your book might say an obsession? Was there something that happened that made you think, wow, there's more to this story?
Yeah, well, I've always enjoyed rope work and dealing with ropes aboard various boats that I've been on. We've always had boats when I was growing up. And after my dad died, I brought some milk crates back from his house in Connecticut back here to Maine. And I used the rope inside those crates for various tasks around the house. But one day I pulled out a piece of rope and I looked at the knot in it, and it suddenly struck me that my dad's fingers had tied that knot. And I just I thought, wow, I really can't untie that knot. I have to leave it just as is. So it really got to me, and I put it up on the wall. And then I just started thinking about rope and thinking about I did some research and found that no one had actually ever written a book about rope. So I thought, This is a great topic that's never really been addressed.
So when we talk about rope, what do we mean exactly? What defines rope? What is rope as opposed to something else?
Right. Well, usually it's comprised of multiple short fibers that have been turned into yarns in the spinning process, much like you would to make yarn for knitting. And then those yarns are combined into strands, are twisted into strands, and then typically there are three strands are then twisted in the opposite direction to make completed rope. So rope is really, I used a very wide definition of rope for this book. I included everything from small cordage to wire rope to possible future rope. So I cast a wide net, and nets also are made of rope.
I thought as you said that, cast a wide net, that you said that on purpose. That was actually one of the first things that was really fascinating to me, that the way rope is made, and spinners will know this, is that the little strands inside of it are twisted one way, and then those strands are twisted together the other way. Why is that?
Well, the opposite twists, the two twists work against each other. It's called either a Z twist or an S twist. The Z twist is a right hand twist, and the S twist is a left hand twist. So, for example, when you make you're making the yarns, you twist them. You might twist them Z twist, and then when you're making the strands, you would do an S twist, the opposite direction, and then the strands twisted into the rope would be Z twist again. So the making the twists in opposite directions has them working against each other to help stop them from unlaying.
Wow. So let's talk about the history of rope. Of course, it is hard to know for sure how long humans have been using rope because of its very nature. It's been made of organic material, and so it deteriorates. But there's a cave in France that gives us some examples, some of idea about how long humans may have been using rope.
Yes, that's right. This cave in southeastern France, right near the Rhone River. And they researchers actually have been in this cave for years, because there are many examples of Neanderthal habitation in this cave. And these two researchers, an American researcher, a professor at Oberlin, and also at a French researcher, they were doing research, and they found on the bottom of this flint flake, a flake of flint that was being used to probably to make some other type of tool, either an arrowhead or a spearhead. They found a piece of rope, and this rope was very small, and they had to actually use a scanning electron microscope to determine that it had both the Z twist and the S twist. It was actually three strand, I guess you could call it cordage, because it was very thin, but it had those elements of the Z and the S twist. So these researchers determined that in fact Neanderthals had the ability to think mathematically in an abstract way. So it was pretty pretty impressive.
Yeah, and how old do they think this is?
50,000 years old.
50,000 years old. And yeah, that's what was so interesting to me. It was one thing to find this piece of rope that was 50,000 years old, but it made people completely rethink what they had assumed about Neanderthals.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That in order to keep track of when you've done, how you've twisted each of the various strands and then twisting them back the other way, it does definitely require some abstract thinking.
Yeah, abstract thinking, and then possibly communication as well to teach somebody else how to do it. So interesting. So you come to this subject as a sailor, and of course, rope has long been important for boats and ships. You can't hoist a sail without a rope. But you've gone into also how important rope is in the building of ships. What did your research tell you about the earliest civilizations to use ropes for sea travel and trade?
Yeah, that's a great subject, because there, I think in Maine, for example, and in sort of in Western countries, we're very familiar with the idea of building a ship or building a boat by laying a keel and then building ribs and then attaching planks to those ribs. And that's the way that we tend to build boats. But in ancient times, boat builders actually used a very different method, where they had planks, but they actually stitched the planks together using rope. So they're actually all held together by rope. And then they would put in they'd put in some internal frames after they'd finished stitching all the planks together. So there were some frames, but it was really the rope stitching that kept all the planks together in the shape of the boat. So that just shows how important rope was to ancient cultures like the Egyptians. This is, for example, the way the Egyptians built all their boats, by stitching them together.
What's so interesting too is that the ropes were not that easy to make. It wasn't as though they were just using cotton fiber or something like that. The whole process was really complicated.
Yeah, they didn't. In latter years, in for example, the 19th century, you have the big rope walks, these very long buildings, and the sort of the mechanization of making rope, the early mechanization of it. But yeah, they had to do everything by hand in Egypt, and it's amazing to me that they're able to make the length of ropes that they did, because they didn't have the rope walk situation. They had to basically stretch it out inside a probably outside actually on in a, on a long big yard and do this work. So it probably was very labor intensive, and they used sometimes they used papyrus, but also they used something called halfa grass, which is grows readily in the along the Nile River.
What was I going to say? Tell us some of the other materials that were used throughout the ancient times to use to make rope.
Well, so the halfa grass, papyrus, and various other products such as flax. Flax was used to make rope, and then of course the king of all fiber, natural fiber, rope materials is hemp. Hemp actually makes fantastic rope, and for a long time, for I'd say probably most of human history, hemp was grown not for its its recreational uses, shall we say, but for making getting the fiber for rope, and then also also for canvas, and you could make canvas and clothes and stuff out of hemp fiber as well.
When you were researching how rope was used in the construction of ancient boats, were there any big surprises for you? Anything that you just spent months scratching your head, like, how did they do that?
Well, I mean, the way they would notch these, cut the notches in the planks to in order so they could fit the rope through was pretty amazing considering the tools they had. But I think the most amazing thing for me was the story of the discovery of Khufu's boat alongside the Great Pyramid, and this was a boat that Egyptologists aren't sure exactly what it was for, but they think perhaps it was for him to sail around in the afterlife on. And it was all disassembled into pieces, and it had to be would have to have been reassembled. But it was found in a pit alongside the Great Pyramid. And but what was also found were big piles of three-strand rope. And when I saw when I just even before I started writing the book, I saw a picture of this of the rope, and it was amazing that this rope looked like you could have gone down to a chandlery and here in town and here in Portland and bought a piece of this rope. It looked as modern as any rope you'd ever seen, and it was 4,500 years old.
Wow. Well, you're speaking of the pyramids. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the use of ropes in construction. I've seen pictures, and I know there's been so much speculation about how the Great Pyramids were built, but I've seen lots of pictures of ramps and levers and things like that. How are ropes used in the building of the pyramids, or what do they think?
Well, as you say, we don't really know exactly how the pyramids were made, and sort of the prevailing idea is that they used ramps. But of course, with ramps, you eventually building the ramp becomes more of a job than building the pyramid as you get to the higher levels. So that doesn't seem like that's how they did it. But anyway, you could have lots of workers to move these 2.5 ton stones around that, for example, that were used for the Great Pyramid. These 2.5 ton limestone blocks, you could have 1,000 people to move that block, but not all of them can get their hands and actually physically push on the block to move it. But if you put a rope around that block and then extend it out in front of the block, then they can all get onto that rope and haul. So you can make a very easy job of it with those 1,000 people. So the rope was really essential for moving the blocks around and getting them into position.
Tell us about other ways in which rope has been used in sort of these mind-boggling buildings that many people have visited Europe and visited some of the extraordinary Gothic cathedrals with just soaring ceilings. And you say rope was essential in this. And I didn't know about the pulleys that were up at the top.
Right. Well, before we get into the pulleys, one of the ways that rope is absolutely essential was that you don't generally think about, and I didn't really think about until I had started researching this, is that the the platforms, the scaffoldings that the workers would actually use to build the walls, they didn't build scaffolding all over the place and just leave it in place. They actually built scaffolding only for those sections that they were working on. And it was wooden pieces of wood that were lashed together with rope. And so they could build a section of scaffolding, work on that section of the wall, and then take the scaffolding down by unlashing it, moving it, rebuilding it in another section, relashing all these pieces together, and then continue on. So rope actually was absolutely essential for this process of building the scaffolding that the workers worked on. Just because building all of the scaffolding all the way around the cathedral would have been very expensive, because all this stuff costs money. We actually have records that talk about the costs for rope and these poles used for building the scaffolding. That was one reason. The other reason is because a lot of these cathedrals actually were starting to be used fairly early on, before they were completed, were being used for both services and for other uses. The floor areas were, so they didn't want to completely cover the floor with scaffolding. They wanted to be able to use it. So that was why rope was important there. But the other thing that you mentioned was the cranes, and the cranes that they used to pull material up, carry material up to the top of the walls as they were working on them. They used these tread wheel cranes, which is essentially a human hamster wheel. It's a person inside who walks, and as he walks, the wheel turns, and it turns a spindle, which takes up the rope and raises the material up to a higher level. So yeah, these treadwheel cranes were really great. And they use these treadwheel cranes, and in fact, in some places, in some cathedrals in Europe, the cranes are still there. They would work their way up to the top, and after they finished the cathedral, they would just leave the treadwheel crane up there. So which is pretty funny.
So the crane that was what was so fascinating to me, that over the years of the construction of the cathedral, at some point there was a man standing in this, walking way up high, so
Right.
that you could pull ropes up and pull these stones up. Just I can't even imagine. And of course, it makes you think, well, humans have always been pretty ingenious, haven't they?
They have. I mean, the treadwheel cranes were being used by all the way back to the Romans. And there are some examples in Roman sculpt. There's a Roman sculpture that shows a treadwheel crane with five guys inside of it. So, that must have been truly impressive, how much they could lift with that thing.
Oh my goodness. Well, we are speaking with Tim Queeney. He is the author of the new book, Rope: How a Bundle of Twisted Fibers Became the Backbone of Civilization. When we come back, we'll take your comments and questions. Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are talking about rope. My guest today is Tim Queeney, and his new book is called Rope: How a Bundle of Twisted Fibers Became the Backbone of Civilization. Tim is a Maine author and a longtime sailor. We invite you to join the conversation. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Before we go to listener calls, Tim, I understand you have a quick correction.
Yes, I misspoke. I'm very sorry about this to Dr. Bruce Hardy, who was one of the people who found the oldest rope at 50,000 years old. He is not a professor at Oberlin. He is a professor at Kenyon College. I'm very sorry about that.
Okay, and I will note that I'm going to forgive you because I was looking at the bibliography on this, and I think you have something like 160 sources. never mind all the interviews you did. It's hard to keep them all straight, I'm sure. Live on the radio, we'll go to Torbert calling from York. Hi, Torbert, go ahead.
Good morning, Jennifer and guests. A little known aspect of the production of hemp for rope took place in the when the World War II broke out. The marijuana prohibition, cannabis prohibition of the 30s was taken off so that Midwest farmers could grow mass quantities of hemp for the war effort. The Navy needed a lot, and the combat engineers and so on. Of course, after the war, prohibition went back on, and that essentially eliminated the domestic hemp production. However, there was a lot of hemp still growing in the roadside ditches of the Middle West, and the entrepreneurial hippies of the late 60s, early 70s discovered this and made pilgrimages and filled up their vans with this free, wild, or feral cannabis. And this was distributed in the cities of the East in particular, around Baltimore, Washington, and I think probably had something to do with the widespread acceptance of it. It wasn't very good, low THC, but it was better than the high prices the mafia cannabis cost.
All right. Well, Torbert, that's so interesting. And Tim was nodding as you were talking about World War II. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's Trevor is exactly right. I mean, there was a tremendous amount of rope required for all the naval vessels alone during the war. And so a lot of that was hemp rope, in fact. But one interesting thing that I uncovered in my book was that if you remember, the gliders that were used where an aircraft would, usually a C-47, would tow a glider behind behind it. And the glider was full of troops or equipment. And those were used at D-Day, for example, in the Normandy invasion. But all of those tow ropes were made out of this newfangled stuff that had just been invented called nylon. And nylon ropes were used because they stretched quite a bit more than a hemp rope. And they could take the stretching as the two planes were flying along and hitting the air at different times. So, that was a very early use of nylon.
Jeff on Facebook writes, I believe the engineer who designed the Brooklyn Bridge also invented a wire rope machine and used it on the bridge as they laid the giant cables in place. And Jeff, thank you for bringing that up. Tim, you have a section in your book about the building of the Brooklyn Bridge.
Yes, that's right. Washington Roebling was one of the first Americans engineers. John Roebling, my mistake, his father, John Roebling. John Roebling came from Germany originally. Originally, he was an immigrant, and he came from Germany, and he was an engineer, and he was involved in a number of projects. And then he found out about an early German use of iron made it, instead of making the strands of the rope out of hemp, they made them out of iron. And so they made wire rope, which was considerably stronger, obviously, than hemp rope. And so John Roebling realized that this could be used in suspension bridges, and he started his own company to make wire rope.
And I'm going to prompt you to go on, though, because it's a very dramatic event that concerns the Roeblings.
Yes. Well, unfortunately for the elder Roebling, he got his foot crushed by as he was starting there, just surveying the original building of the bridge. He was involved in an accident. A ferry boat came and crushed his foot. And unfortunately, he refused to get any treatment for it. And it eventually, I believe it was gangrene, eventually killed him. And then while they were building the bridge, there was an accident where they, I won't go into all the details, it's pretty technical, but essentially, the device that they were using to pull this cable from one side to the other and attach it to the anchor was actually cut into the metal of the steel of the cable, and the cable released, and unfortunately it killed some of the workers and badly injured some of the other ones. So it was a very deadly example of rope giving way, wire rope.
An email here from Carl. About 30 years ago, there was a rope company down around Waldo County that appeared to be a rapidly growing business. I think they built a brand new production plant on Route 17 or Route 3. Then after a short period of operation, it appeared they went out of business. What happened? Also, my son and daughter do a lot of rock climbing and slot canyoneering. They use dynamic and static climbing rope for those two different uses. Could you explain the differences? So two questions here from Carl, Tim. The first, do you know about this rope company that used to be in Waldo County?
Unfortunately, I don't know anything about that.
Okay. And what about the difference between dynamic and static climbing rope?
Yes, that's a very good question because that brings up the whole issue, the whole subject of what's called kern mantle rope, which is very different way to build rope than use it than making 3-strand rope or 4-strand in the traditional way. A kern mantle rope has a central core of fibers that are very, very strong, and then it has a braided cover which protects those fibers. And in static ropes, I hope I don't get this wrong because I'm not a kern mantle expert, but and I believe in static ropes, the interior of the interior fibers are straight, laid alongside each other. They're not twisted at all. And in a dynamic rope, they are twisted so that there's some give there when the rope is, for example, if a climber were to fall, that there would be some give to the rope as it took up his weight or her weight.
We'll go to Al, who's calling from Kittery Point. Hi, Al, go ahead.
Hi, this is Al off of Kittery Point. And I work in the theater in New York City. And
Al, I'm going to stop you just a second. Could you hold your phone a little closer to your mouth? You're hard to understand.
Yes. So years ago, I worked in New York City in the theater business. And they were still using hemp in the 70s and earlier. And it happens that the theaters that used the hemp were called hemp houses. I was wondering if the author had done any research.
Yeah, so Tim, talking about theater and hemp rope used in theater and hemp houses. Go ahead.
Yes, that's right. It's interesting that you know that term, hemp houses. Yes, the rope was very extensively used in the theater for moving the scenery around, for pulling the flies up and the backdrops. I actually went to 3 different Broadway theaters and looked at and interviewed the head carpenters about how they used rope. And up to a very short time ago, even Broadway theaters were still using hemp rope and not synthetic rope, modern synthetic rope. And they were, in fact, the ones that were still using hemp rope were called hemp houses because they still had using the hemp rope. And according to the head carpenters, they all were said the main reason that the hemp was still being used long beyond when it probably should have been was because it was a lot cheaper than buying the synthetic rope, which is more expensive. But one of the head carpenters did point out that the danger of hemp rope is that it rots when it gets wet, and it can rot from the inside out. So you can look at a piece of hemp rope and it looks perfectly fine, but it could be rotten on the inside. And he actually told me an example of lifting a fly and during a production and having the rope break on him, and he fell to the floor, and that all the rope came down on top of him. But
Oh dear, and
so
we don't want props falling on actors during program during the play either.
right. He's not a big fan of hemp rope.
Al, thanks for calling. We'll go to Portland and Jamie. Hi, Jamie, go ahead.
Oh, hey, this is maybe just a fun one. I don't know the fishing culture and you know what's a passage for people, but I think of the movie where Quint asked Hooper and Jaws to tie some knot, right? That was supposedly hard, and Richard Dreyfuss rolls his eyes, and later in the movie, Roy Scheider ties a knot. He's real proud of it. But is there like a rite of passage for knot tying, and if you're a fisherman, because those were kind of a poignant points of the movie, and just curious.
Sure, talking about Jaws, Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I don't know the exact knots that modern fishermen and lobstermen exactly need to know, but they certainly need to know knots even to this day, and certainly in the past, sailors really needed to know knots, especially in the age of sail when there was a tremendous use of rope. To control the vessels, and you needed to know not only how to tie knots at night during a storm, but you also needed to know what all the various running rigging of the ship, the running rigging that controls the sails and the yard arms. You needed to know where all those, how all the various ropes worked, and if you were told to go put your hand on a rope during the middle of a storm, you needed to be able to go do that and not pull on or release the wrong rope, which could cause a lot of damage or get somebody hurt.
Jamie, thanks for your call. And I do want to mention, since you mentioned Jaws, that tomorrow's Maine Calling program is about sharks. So stay tuned for that. We will go to Heidi calling from Liberty. Hi, Heidi. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to give an answer to one of your callers. The company in Searsmont was called Crow Rope. That's C-R-O-W-E. I don't know anything about it, but it was there for a long time.
Well, thanks, Heidi. Nice to hear your voice. Tim, so Crow Rope, is that something you'd heard about?
Unfortunately, that doesn't ring a bell.
But there are still rope manufacturers in Maine, correct?
Yes, there are. Yeah, Yale Cordage still makes ropes in Saco.
All right, Heidi, thanks so much. An email here from Elizabeth. I am as fascinated by rope as your guest. I look forward to getting his book. I am the artistic director for the Bear Mountain Music Hall in Waterford. Next Saturday, August 23rd, we will be having a kids' day with various demonstrations. I will be demonstrating traditional rope making, which is a hands-on demonstration. Kids can participate in the process. The event is free and kid-friendly snacks will be provided. Contact me directly for more information or check out our Facebook page. So that's Elizabeth at the Bear Mountain Music Hall in Waterford. So pretty neat, Tim. You can still see how rope used to be made, at least here in the United States.
Right, exactly.
And Maggie says, might Mr. Queenie wish to speak about the impact of the hemp rope prohibition on Maine rope production? Is that something you looked into for your book?
Not that specific topic, no. The subject that I covered in terms of the natural fiber was more the evolution from natural fibers to synthetic fibers.
All right. Well, you know, we talked about the use in building and we talked about the use of rope in shipbuilding, but something that's really important we haven't talked about yet, Tim, is the use of rope in communication, or at least string in communication. And so fascinating to learn what you learned about the Inca civilization and how these strands were used there.
Yes, the Inca used a device called a quipu, which was a bunch of knotted cords that hung, that when you were looking at it, they would hang vertically. You would hold the main cord, which would be horizontal cord, and then you'd look at the vertical cords, and they would all be knotted, and they'd use four different types of knots, and the position of the knots and the type of knot could convey information, usually be numerical information. It would be census data or something of that nature. There are some quipu researchers who are firm believers that they actually had a narrative function as well, that they could tell stories with the quipu. But unfortunately, the way to decipher these quipu, a lot of it was lost when many of the quipu were destroyed by the Spanish when they conquered the Inca Empire. But although quipu making continued on, and even to this day, there are people in the high Andes who still make quipu. A lot of them are funerary quipu that are buried with people, and as a way of they're usually knotted. The way they're knotted are to indicate prayers, Catholic prayers.
And of course, rope, and especially when you're using, including steel cables into that, is essential for communication for a very long time.
That's right. I did cover the transatlantic cable laying that took place in the 19th century. Amazingly enough, I was even surprised to find out that the first one was completed in 1858, before the Civil War. Unfortunately, it only lasted about 3 weeks before it failed. So then the Civil War intervened, and after the Civil War, then there was it was a joint British-American effort to build and lay these cables across the Atlantic. And then, of course, after the Civil War, they did, in fact, successfully complete a transatlantic cable that lasted much longer. And then those were followed by more cables.
Well, when we come back, I want to ask you, Tim, about the future of rope, present and future, and what rope might look like in the future. Also, you have a great story about the USS Constitution. We want to know your questions or comments about rope and the role of rope throughout history. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're learning all about rope and how important it has been throughout history. My guest is Maine author Tim Queeney. His new book, Rope, How a Bundle of Twisted Fibers Became the Backbone of Civilization. You can share your comments and emails. If you're very quick, you can send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. There are so many vignettes, so many great little stories in your book, Tim, but anybody who's been to Boston and has visited the USS Constitution may particularly like one, how the USS Constitution escaped five British ships during the War of 1812.
Yeah, that's quite a story. I actually read that story when I was probably 12 years old, and it's always stayed in my mind. And then I realized it's actually a great story to tell for this book. Captain Isaac Hull was commanding the Constitution, and he was sailing north along the New Jersey coast to get to New York, where he was supposed to join a squadron of U.S. ships. And so he saw these five ships on the horizon and assumed that that was the squadron he was supposed to join. So he kept sailing toward them, and then realized, in fact, they were British ships and had to turn around and start fleeing them. And of course, they chased him avidly, but then the wind died. So all these ships are 20 miles off the New Jersey coast, and there's virtually no wind. So the Constitution put out their ships' boats, and using these long ropes, they started rowing and towing the vessel. And then the British ships did the same thing. So now all these vessels are being towed along by these sweating sailors. And then the lieutenants on board the Constitution had the idea, why don't we use our kedge anchor? And a kedge anchor is a smaller anchor that you actually use to pull yourself along. And you can do that by taking the kedge anchor way out in front of the vessel, dropping it to the bottom, and then you pull on the anchor rod, the anchor cable, with using a human-powered winch called a capstan. So all the crew are doing capstan duty and pulling this anchor cable in, and then they would get the kedge up. When they were right over the Constitution was right over the kedge, they would raise the kedge up to the surface, put it on a boat, take it way out in front of the boat, and drop it to the bottom again, and then kedge toward it again. And they found that they had more than a mile of rope on board, and they attached all these ropes together and attach that to the kedge anchor. And so they brought it way out in front of the boat and dropped it and pulled themselves along. And that was a more efficient system than the guys stayed in the ship's boats and rowing as well. So they were using both methods. And then the British ships started copying that approach as well. So this went on for hours, hour after hour. I don't know how the crew did this. This was an absolutely amazing human effort to continue to do this for hours. I think it was something like 16 hours they did this, until finally the wind came up, and luckily for Constitution, the wind came up for them first, because they were south of the British ships, and they were able to sail away from the British ships and escape. But it was quite a feat.
And boy, what a stressful 16 hours. We're going to go to Al, who's calling from Alna. Hi, Al, go ahead.
Thank you. How are you today?
Wonderful.
Good. I grew up with rope, and cut me off when I talk too much. I'll go on forever. But my dad was a rope engineer. He graduated from college. Cordage engineer is what he was called. And he worked for a number of rope companies up and down the East Coast. But he worked for this wall rope down in New Jersey, and that's where I grew up. And they manufactured a whole line. But what was interesting, they had a rope walk. It wasn't in service when I was a little kid, but it was still there, where they would actually make the hemp rope, but it wasn't made and rolled like it is today. It was made in like, I don't know, it was 100-yard long building, low roofed, and they would take the strands and they'd weave them together. And that's how originally the rope was made there. But of course, then they moved up to machinery. And his job mostly entailed working on the rivers, the Mississippi, the Ohio, those rivers where the big barges would be pulled up and down the river. There might be 40 barges on a boat. And every time they came to a lock, they'd have to untie all these barges, fit only what they could in, lift them up and move on. But these ropes were big and they'd have problems with them. And his job was, he spent a lot of time on the rivers in these river boats, seeing how they were used. He'd come back and he'd design a rope that would work efficiently. They had a lot of problems with things called hockling. When you put a huge weight on a rope and release it, the rope will just roll in on itself and have these knots, and it's ruined. You see it sometime in sailboats and stuff where they go around the mooring the wrong way, and the rope will hockle. But going down through the years, the rope manufacturing started going overseas like everything else, and he moved. Well, wall rope went belly up, and he moved down to North Carolina. That went belly up. To South Carolina, that went belly up. And finally ended up down in Louisiana. I think it was American Rope and retired there. And I think they may still make rope. But the majority of rope, unless it's like a specific, like this company in Maine makes, is all manufactured out of the country now. Nothing, very little is made here in this country. They can't compete anymore.
Oh, so interesting. Yeah, to grow up with a cordage engineer. Tim, as you listen to Al speak, is there anything that really strikes you?
Well, yeah, the whole issue of putting the strands together properly was a big deal, actually, in the very early stages of rope, especially in the maritime usage, when especially for standing rigging on a ship, where the standing rigging would be highly tensioned. And the standing rigging is that rigging that holds the masts in place. So that has to be fixed and be very tight to keep the masts from basically from falling over. So this one British captain, Joseph Huddart, he found that a lot of the standing rigging was failing because of the way that some of the strands would break. And he determined that it was because of the way the strands were being constructed was that it was because they were being sort of pre-tensioned, that what was going in sort of ad hoc, the strands were being made in a sort of an ad hoc fashion, and some were being more heavily tensioned than others. And the ones that were heavily tensioned were the ones that were breaking. So he invented a very simple metal plate with holes in it, and that it just, which properly fed all the individual yarns into a position so that when the strand was twisted, they would all be tensioned at the proper amount. And so he did away with a lot of these rig failures because his ropes were could handle the stress much more evenly.
Al, thank you so much for calling in. And a related email, Bruce writes, in Bath, on old maps, one can see the old rope walk next to the cabin restaurant. It was a long, straight, flat boardwalk adjacent to the shipyards where the rope handlers could lay out, wind together, and roll up long strands of rope to use on the ships being built or refitted. So another example of a rope walk. Here's an email from Sana. We were talking about crow rope earlier. She says, Sana seems to know a lot here. During the Korean War, Byron Crow served as a corporal in the U.S. Army stationed in France. After discharge from the Army, he returned to Coventry to take over the operation of his father's lace mill, manufacturing Lever's lace. In the late 1950s, he designed and constructed his first rope machines with the help of his mentor and friend, Old Man Boglin. In the 1960s, he began Crow Rope Company in Warren, Maine. Crow Rope eventually employed 500 employees, its fleet of trucks delivering rope across the country. At its height, Crow was the largest supplier of twisted rope to the U.S. government. Byron helped revolutionize the lobster industry in Maine with the introduction of the first hydraulic pot haulers and synthetic rope to lobstermen up and down the coast. They are still in use around the world. So that's terrific. Tim, when you revise your book, that can
I'll
go
have to
in
put
there.
Something in there about crow rope. I apologize to all the Mainers, all the maritime Mainers, that I did not include that.
All right. So I want to ask you, Tim, though, you know, one might think, well, I understand why ropes were so important in early navigation, in early construction of these incredible cathedrals and things like that. But boy, rope may be less important today than it was in the past. After all, ships have engines, builders have modern equipment like cranes, surveyors and others use drones. But you argue that rope is more important than ever. Talk to me about that thinking.
It's still being used in surprising ways. I have a whole chapter on how it's being used in science. There's a neutrino detection device called Ice Cube, which is in the ice, a mile down in the ice at the South Pole, and they have these various detectors that are frozen into the ice, and they can detect when a neutrino hits the ice and causes what's called Cherenkov radiation. But in order to lower these detectors down in, they used rope. So just good old fashioned rope to lower these detectors down into the ice after they drilled the holes. So that's an example of a modern use of rope. And then the other amazing thing is that the Mars landings, the Mars rovers like Curiosity, those rovers could not have landed on the moon. I'm sorry, on Mars without the use of rope. The rope was used for the parachutes, and also was used for actually the final lowering of the lander down onto the surface from the sky crane. So those are two examples. And then there's the possibility of a future type of rope, again, the wide net definition, for use in something called a space elevator.
I wanted to ask you about space
really
elevators.
Amazing.
What on earth is a space elevator?
Well, imagine taking a rock and tying a rock to the end of a piece of rope and then twirling around in a circle. What's going to happen to that rock? Well, it's going to go extend out in a circle around you, and that rope's going to become super tight as the rock pulls on the rope as it wants to fly away. Well, that's the centrifugal tendency or centrifugal force, and you could do the same thing with a weight extended 100,000 kilometers up into space, attached to a tether, which goes down and is attached to the surface of the Earth. And in that case, the weight has that centrifugal energy, and it wants to go flying off in an angle, but the tether is keeping it flying in a circle, and that tether gets barred tight. And now you can put a crawling device, which uses tension wheels, to just crawl up that tether up to whatever altitude you want to get into orbit, for something to be in orbit. And you'd open the doors and push out your satellite at 20,000 miles up, and it's in geosynchronous orbit. So this would be a way to basically get into orbit not using chemical rockets, but just using these space elevators. And in order to do that, you need a very high, very, very strong type of material. And that's the real reason why, or one of the reasons why, it hasn't been done up to now, because we haven't had the material that's strong enough to make the cable, the tether. But now there are developments in something, device called graphene, a material called graphene, which is made of carbon, a single atomic layer of carbon atoms, which form a hexagonal ring. And that hexagonal ring, and all the hexagonal rings are all connected to each other, but that it forms the strongest bond known in science. Mm. And so then you can lay down layer after layer of these one atomic level of carbon, and you create this graphene tether, and it is strong enough to do this job. And now it's just a matter of actually building this thing.
Hmm. Wow. We're going to squeeze in one more call. We'll go to John calling from Portland. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. Good afternoon. A quick question. I'm not certain whether the author remembers or is aware, there used to be a rope walk on Park Street in Portland, right near where the brick row houses are. I'm not certain whether he remembers or ever heard of a rope walk being in that location. Again, Park Street in Portland, near the old Victorian mansion.
John, that's where my first apartment was in Maine. So a rope walk right in downtown Portland. Tim, they're probably everywhere, right?
Yeah, that's the thing that especially in, I mean, rope was used obviously for agricultural use, but also for maritime use. Rope was absolutely essential. So just about every port in America had their own rope walk or rope walks, various companies making rope. So yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all that there was a rope walk in Portland. Probably there were several.
John, thanks so much for your call. And that will be our last question. Tim Queenie, our guest today, thank you for joining us. His book, just out yesterday, he's the author of Rope, How a Bundle of Twisted Fibers Became the Backbone of Civilization. Today's sound engineer was Chris Bridges. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk about those recent shark sightings and what the public needs to know about sharks in Maine waters. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.